If they collapse to occupy a small volume of space, then the former mass of the star remains, while there's only a very short distance to the center of the hole. This combination of huge mass with small volume creates the black hole's powerful gravity. No black holes are known for certain, but several very likely candidates have been found in our galaxy, and really big ones probably lurk at the centers of most galaxies. Their powerful gravity is what helps us discover them. A big black hole noticeably affects the orbits of stars and gas clouds anywhere in its vicinity. Even an ordinary smaller black hole would have such powerful gravity that it would exert an inescapable pull on anything and everything passing near. Its gravity would act on neighboring stars and surrounding space to make the black hole's presence known. The black hole would be, in effect, an actual hole in the fabric of space-time, a black hole where a star used to be. Stardate is a production of the MacDonald Observatory at the University of Texas at Austin. And for the MacDonald Observatory, I'm Joel Block.
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
Changed. The new number is 2. Please make a note of it.
Please repeat.
The number you have reached has been changed. The new number has been disconnected.
Green damage.
Möchten Sie etwas zu trinken haben?
Already in progress.
What did you say?
Can you say deja vu?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
Can you say deja vu?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
Can you say deja vu?
Good evening, Vice President Nixon.
Good evening, Mr. Howe.
Welches sind die Regenbogenfarben?
Got to keep the moon on the path.
If you do not push a key in 3 seconds, you will be disconnected.
Mein Bruder ist jünger als ich.
And a very good evening to one and all. And if you are tuned into your radio at this time, you have brain damage on your radio. At 10 minutes after 10 o'clock on a Saturday night, I am Eric Corley with you up until 12, and we have a couple of special guests with us today. But first, let me tell you that we have 1 degree Celsius out of doors, of course. Fortunately, we don't have 1 degree Celsius indoors. And never mind that strange sound you just heard. That was something that shouldn't have happened. It's 11 after 10. The forecast for tonight calls for it to be mostly clear, low in the low 20s, and for Sunday, mostly sunny and mild, high in the mid 40s. And taking a look at the news, we have a rather interesting item that just came over the news wires, and something we'll be talking about tonight, and something which you, our listeners, can feel free to talk about. Let me give out the phone number at this point, 632-6901, area code 516. You can call us up and be on the airwaves, which is always a lot of fun, 632-6901. And the news item which just came in is Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega has lifted a state of emergency in his country. At the close of a Central American summit conference in Costa Rica, Ortega also said tonight his leftist government would open direct ceasefire talks with the U.S.-funded Contra rebels within the next few days. In the past, Ortega had said he would never take those steps as long as war raged in Nicaragua. The summit broke up without the 5 Central American presidents mentioning a new deadline to implement provisions of a regional peace plan. Throughout the summit, the Nicaraguan president was under heavy pressure from his fellow chief executives to comply more fully with the pact. Ortega also said his government would grant amnesty to all political prisoners arrested after 1981 once a ceasefire takes hold and the rebels blend into the Nicaraguan society. If no ceasefire is reached, he says Nicaragua would free the prisoners if the United States or any other non-Central American country decides to accept them. And as I said, we will be getting back to that throughout the night. And if you have any questions or comments, things you'd like to say about this interesting news development, give us a call, 632-6901. Another news, a published report quotes a Muslim leader as saying kidnappers holding the Lebanon hostages will not consider releasing them until President Reagan leaves office next year. The London Sunday Express also reports that Anglican envoy Terry Waite, who disappeared in Lebanon last year, is in good health. An opposition leader predicts tomorrow's election in Haiti will be boycotted by most Haitians. As proof, he cites today's general strike, in which businesses closed and people stayed off the streets to protest the country's military-led junta. And at a debate in New Hampshire, Republican presidential candidate Pete DuPont today gave himself credit for taking strong action. The appearance came after DuPont asked his name to be pulled from the Texas primary because of forged petition signatures. Sports commentator Jimmy the Greek Snyder's contract with CBS was to have expired tomorrow, but he was fired today, one day after making controversial comments about blacks in a broadcast interview. And again, it's 1 degree Celsius here. We'll be getting down into the 30s tonight. And tomorrow, we're expecting it to be mostly sunny, milder in the afternoon with highs in the mid-40s. And we'll be back with phone calls and our special guests right after this.
Hello, this is Judy Collins. On January 18th, we will celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday as a national holiday. It's a day to honor his life and dream. Remember what Martin Luther King Jr. stood for. Live the dream. For more information, call the New York State Martin Luther King Commission. Phone toll-free 1-800-647-KING.
And our telephone number is 632-6901, area code 516. We have a couple of special guests with us, both from the Democratic Socialists of America. We have Elisa McBride, who is the youth organizer for the DSA, and Bill Spencer, National Executive Committee of the Democratic Socialists of America. And I guess probably the first thing I should ask you folks is, what is the Democratic Socialists of America? If you can sum it up in perhaps a few sentences, so people who have never heard of it before would know.
Okay, well, the common misperception is that we're a political party, which we're not. We're an organization of socialists in the U.S., and we work within the Democratic Party, and we attempt to do socialist politics within the political context of the United States, and it's, you know, the constraints that we have, which is a two-party system, and we're an organization which has a vibrant youth section, which is my major concern, and I like to say that it's the most vital part of the organization. We have 40 campus chapters. We have couple thousand on the mailing list, and we do campus politics on all different issues. We're a multi-issue organization, and we have students working on a whole range of different types of projects all over the U.S. on different campuses. And the national organization, on the national committee that Bill is on, directs the national organization, which has local chapters all over the country. So we're a national organization which has a lot of local activities going on in different regions of the country. And we work on a variety of different issues.
I see. Bill, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
No, not a lot. We're the, you know, and it's always hard to talk about, you know, in the American political perspective, a set of politics that's a little bit outside of the normal range. We are the affiliate in the United States of the Socialist International, an international body that includes such groups as the French Socialist Party, the British Labor Party, and so forth. So internationally, the types of political positions that we work on are considered quite normal. And in fact, the United States is the only large country that doesn't have a mass socialist movement like that.
We're also the only large country that hasn't adopted the metric system either.
Yeah.
Lagging behind on quite a few things, I guess.
But the only industrialized country other than South Africa that doesn't have some sort of national health care system as well.
Uh-huh. Well, let me just ask, why do you think that is? Is there something wrong with us? why do we lag behind on such supposedly important things?
The metric system, you mean?
Well, metric system, forms of government, health care, all that kind of thing.
There's a long history of debates about what's called American exceptionalism, you know, where people sort of look at other countries like ours, even countries like Canada that are, you know, very close culturally as well as geographically, that seem to have, you know, a more advanced welfare state, a social system that provides more securities for people, and, you know, people trying to explain why the United States doesn't have these things. I think there's a whole range of reasons that go back to what Elisa said. You know, there's a two-party political system. It's hard to get representation. things that go back to the history of how the vote was won in the United States. It was won before the Industrial Revolution, whereas in other countries it was often organizations of the working class that actually fought for the vote and won it. It goes back to questions around the, you know, frontier and an individualist political ideology. I think the important thing, and the thing that's interesting when you talk about socialist politics or radical democratic politics, is that there's a lot in the American tradition that makes sense in these terms. You know, the tradition of helping your neighbors, mutuality. There's nothing about the politics that we advocate that's really alien to most American people. And if you go down on a list of programs, many of them agree with us. What you don't have is a major political party representing that point of view.
Now, you mentioned that you're affiliated with the Socialist Party of France, I believe. Now, for me, that's kind of hard to understand because, the Democrats and the Republicans, they're just Democrats and Republicans for this country. They're not affiliated with anyone from another country. So, now, perhaps that's a problem for some people thinking of a political group affiliated with groups in other countries, and it seems maybe sort of like an invasion or something. Can you address that, explain why that is?
Yeah, well, we don't take our orders from anybody except for, members of ours around this country. But we are part of an international body. It's called the Socialist International. And it's a forum for discussion of people from, you know, countries around the world, not just European countries. In fact, there's been a shift within that body where most of the member countries are from third world nations now. And it's one of the major international forums for discussions of things like the relationship between disarmament and development, international measures that should be taken to protect the ecology, things like that. So it's not a binding political relation. It's not like we take, you know, orders from anyone, but we do share some of the same visions and advocate some of the same positions as our, you know, friends and fellow socialist, democratic socialists around the world.
If I could add to that, it's a forum for political dialogue, and I think, you know, just to point out that one of the problems I think that both the Democrats and Republicans have in this country, and certainly the Reagan administration, is it doesn't see the real significance of needing to have that sort of international dialogue, that our economic system is an international economic system, that the decisions that we make about, our policies in the U.S. have a great impact on countries all over the world, and that we don't take that into consideration, certainly, and that the UN, the United Nations, which is supposed to be our forum for discussion of international issues, is consistently, snubbed by the U.S. in a variety of ways. That there's a large conference at the UN on disarmament and development this fall, and the U.S. is one of the major players in a lot of the issues that are of concern to other nations around issues of disarmament and development, yet we were one of the few nations that refused to take part in this conference that took place in New York City. You know, that we consider it, it's not important for us to take part in these discussions, and in the UN, where perhaps we don't have the amount of power that Reagan would like to be able to exercise in the world scene, we refuse to take part in any significant way.
So we're not obeying international law, whatever international law exists.
That's true, in several cases. I mean, in Namibia, there's a UN resolution that we have completely disregarded, and the South Africans have completely disregarded. There are all sorts of examples of positions the UN has taken that we don't think it's in our national interest to follow that line, so we decide to ignore its steps.
I see. Now, you folks were on the Phil Donahue show a few days ago. What day was that, actually? That was
Monday the 11th.
Monday the 11th. Now, if anyone out there has seen the Phil Donahue show, and I'm sure some of our listeners must watch Phil Donahue, it's not inconceivable, they would have seen
Barbara Ehrenreich is our chairperson, national chairperson, on the Donahue show, and a whole bunch of us in the audience cheering away for her, having Phil stick his butt in our faces and run around talking to mostly the communists who are across the aisle from us.
So there were two groups.
Right.
There was you and then the
CPUSA, the Communist Party. And they're presidential candidate who's run the past few elections, Gus Hall, although he's not running this time, as he said. He claims it's in protest against the American political system, which doesn't make room for third-party candidates. But Barbara was on, and she actually said quite a few things that I thought really resonated with the people in the audience there, and I hope who are watching the television that she was really able to communicate a democratic socialist vision that, as Bill said, makes sense within the U.S. context. It isn't a foreign thing. That isn't some kind of a bizarre leap of, you know, radical faith or something. You know, that there are examples of needs that we have in this country, needs expressed by people in this country that we're trying to address, that it's not something that is a threatening force in many senses.
I see. Now, before we get into what was said on that program, I kind of like to get an idea of what it's like to be in a situation like that. Now, first of all, how long ago was all this arranged, being on the Phil Donahue show? Why was Phil Donahue interested in socialism and communism and that kind of thing?
Well, actually, I think it's problematic that the reason he was interested is because he wanted to present the sort of lunatic fringe of the U.S. political scene. And these lead-ins he did for the show, the commercials that he did in preparation for it, were communists in America? Yes, there are, and you'll see them on the Donahue show. You know, aren't you scared? And wait till you see them on TV. They're even scarier in person. So it was sort of a freak factor that that Barbara really did a great job of dispelling, but that was his motivation. And in fact, I don't think it was originally planned that we would be on the show, but we managed to convince the people who were putting the show together that indeed it was important to get a socialist perspective that sometimes contrasts very strongly to a communist perspective. And he allowed us to be on the show.
How do you folks feel when someone says you're a communist? I mean, is that offensive to be called a communist when you're actually a socialist?
Well, certainly it indicates, you know, a lack of careful political understanding. I mean, what happens a lot is that you can be an anti-apartheid activist, you can be a civil rights activist, you can be working for the ERA. All of these things are important struggles, but certainly you can be doing these things and be a mainstream Democrat in a lot of cases, and yet people are going to call you a communist, and that's what happens in this country quite a bit, that people use pinko and communist as a dirty word. And I would want to, you know, dispute that to the extent that I feel like people are turning attempts to change sometimes very small, you know, things, make very slight reforms in the U.S. political system into some kind of a monster. But I also feel like it's important to make the distinctions between a communist political system and what we're fighting for, a democratic socialist vision. So, you know, the conflating of the two things is certainly somewhat disturbing, as is using the word communist as some kind of, you know, a cut down in a variety of ways.
Now, there's the Democratic Socialists of America, which is your organization, is the Communist Party of America. How many other groups are there over there? There's
over
on the political left.
Oh, over there. Well, as I said, we're not a party, but there are certainly quite a few third parties or independent political parties in this country besides the Democrats and the Republicans.
Uh-huh.
A lot of them are tiny, but there are a couple that have run candidates. The Citizens Party has run candidates. The Socialist Party runs candidates.
No, you're not affiliated with the Socialist Party?
No.
Okay, why not?
Well, the DSA has roots in the Socialist Party, and certainly we consider ourselves to be trying to carry on the tradition and the vision of Eugene Debs and Norman Thomas and some of these spokespeople for the Socialist Party. But in the 60s, there was a split within the Socialist Party over the issues of the Vietnam War and the question of whether to work within the Democratic Party or outside it. And those people within the Socialist Party who opposed the war in Vietnam and also believed that we should be working within the Democratic Party formed an organization called the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, which is one of the two organizations that came together as DSA in the early 80s. So that's sort of a the history from which we come. And Michael Harrington, who is the other co-chair of the organization, along with Barbara Ehrenreich, has, you know, was from the Socialist Party. He was one of the leaders of DSOC when it split from the Socialist Party.
I see. Let's get back to the to being on the Donahue Show. Now, did he contacted you, I assume. You didn't pursue him to be on that show? Or?
Well, I'm not sure of the details. I think they may have contacted us to ask us to give them information about the Communist Party.
Uh-huh. Now, I saw that program, and it just seemed like he was going for the reactions from some of the crazy people in the audience on the other side, which who just kept talking and talking and then calling you all kinds of horrible names. I'm just curious what it's really like in that kind of a situation. I think we've all seen the show at least once. We've all seen how everyone seems to get all riled up. I mean, are there fist fights in the hall afterwards, or what goes on?
No. Donahue really attempts to, you know, rile people up a little bit and make them feel like they're a great responsive audience in between, you know, during the commercials. This is the best audience I've ever had on this show. You know, he says it a million times. And he's running all around, you know, leaping from person to person. And he really does attempt to get people he doesn't want people actually fighting with each other. And he did try and calm down. If you saw the show, there was one woman who seemed like she was about to leap up on stage and throttle someone, and in fact looked like she was about to physically attack Donahue. But he did, he said, don't you want to listen? He tries to promote these values of, like, listening to each other. And it makes the show a combination of intense energy and this sort of supposed respect for other people's opinions. He definitely wanted to get across this idea that it was legitimate to be a socialist or a communist in the U.S. He certainly made that an assumption of his doing the show and hoped that others would accept that who were on the show as guests, I mean, as audience members.
What percentage of the audience was from your organization? What percentage was just dragged in off the streets or however they do things over there?
Right. They had a lot of people who were, I think, wish they had gotten to sit in on a more interesting topic. But we had 20 or 25 there. The Communist Party had 25 or 30, and then there were another 100 or so in the audience who were mostly women who had come to see the show.
Uh-huh.
I just saw the show from Washington. I wasn't on it. But I wanted to go back to something you mentioned before, how they call people names, and some of the folks in the audience really seemed aghast at the notion that there were socialists in the United States. I think it really, you know, pointed out that the political culture in the United States is a very constricted one. It's not like there are many times where you have a large public discussion of questions of who controls wealth in the society. Why don't people who make goods have a greater say over how they're made? Why don't people have a greater say over the way they run their community? Why don't the citizens of this country as a whole have a greater say in setting of this country's foreign policy? Some of the types of questions that we attempt to raise, you know, why no health care system? Why no guarantee for a job? Why not guaranteed higher education for people who want to go on? You know, these are the types of questions that we've raised and that are sister parties raised around the world, and most people in the United States, you know, are not used to debating those things in public, and so you saw a lot of eyebrows raised very highly.
They're basically debating the very foundations of the country.
I think so, yeah. I think a lot of the, you know, there's certainly a lot about that stands at the foundation of this political culture, including the guarantee of civil liberties and political freedoms that socialists and communists played a large role in winning and that we very much respect. But there are some major questions of power economically and politically that don't seem to get onto the table when the Republicans and Democrats, go at it and talk about politics.
Yeah, I think one major problem with the show was that it didn't really get into this question of what we were trying to do is address what could be done fundamentally differently in the U.S. political system. Unfortunately, we did get somewhat, I think, sidetracked into discussing, you know, it's important to discuss issues of international politics and the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, but I think what it would have been really interesting was to try and address some of the questions being raised by audience members about what relevance all this could have in the U.S. and how answering claims like this could never work in the U.S. People are motivated by self-interest. People can't cooperate. People are only going to be able to deal with a competitive system. You know, you're only going to promote laziness. These sorts of questions that are basically questions of assumptions about human nature and the ways in which we can work together and how our society has to operate. And we could have gotten into a very interesting discussion about the values that guide us in the U.S. political system and the choices that we make about how to operate in our political system and our economic system. Why it is that we don't look to cooperative models like the family for alternatives to a competitive system. Why we don't see the cases in which people are motivated by exactly the opposite of self-interest in their work. You know, that they enjoy their work, that they are inspired by their work, that they care for other people and want to make things more, you know, that, for instance, my mother worked in my family all my life, and I don't think she worked out of pure self-interest or something. You know, she had values about her family that she wanted to care for us, and that was what motivated her in some sense. And I think that we're all motivated by those sorts of desires in our lives, and to look towards those sorts of motivations and values rather than pure self-interest is the only thing which is going to make anyone do anything in our society. I think that's a very pessimistic way to look at human beings, overly pessimistic.
What are some of the symptoms that that you see in our present society that indicate the need for this kind of change?
Mm-hmm. The list of capitalist atrocities, let's pull it out. Well, how about the fact that only half of the potential voting population in the U.S. participates in elections? You know, we claim to be the most democratic nation in the world, yet 27% of the population elected, of the voting population, elected Ronald Reagan to office. And people called it a landslide, by the way. That for students and youth, that those figures are even more dismal, that even fewer young people participate in the political system in this country.
Now, that why is that? Is it because people don't think it works?
I think it's partly that people don't see concrete results from it. That, you know, it goes back to the thing of having a system which only allows for two parties, that people don't see the potential for real change or the ways in which their lives are concretely affected by whether, you know, Ronald Reagan or Albert Gore is in the White House. And indeed, there are some concrete differences. Certainly, any Democrat that is currently running would be much better than any of the Republican candidates for a lot of the work that we are trying to do. On the other hand, it's not always apparent to people that when they are living in desperate poverty, when they are struggling every day to get by, when they are homeless, and homeless people can't vote, by the way, because you need to have a residency in order to be able to register to vote, that your life is going to be affected, that it really matters what's going on up there in the elite echelons of politics in the U.S. And in fact, the 50% of the voting population, the eligible voting population that chooses not to vote, is disproportionately poorer compared to the people who do vote. So there is an actual correlation that your economic situation does have an impact on whether you choose to participate in our political system. It's a good example of the ways in which you can't separate economics and politics, that, you know, your economic situation is going to affect the ways in which you participate, whether you can really impact an election. You know, you certainly have to have quite a bit of money in order to participate in a campaign to any significant extent to be able to make a contribution to a candidate that's going to have any impact on their positions, unless you're part of, you know, there are other ways to impact a politician, for sure, and that's what we try and do in creating mass movements that will attempt to influence politics. But certainly people who have money can use other channels to influence politics in the U.S., and we've seen many examples of that.
I'd like to, you mentioned the homeless not being able to vote. Now, I imagine that's true. true around here, too. The homeless people we see in New York City, they can't vote. They don't have a permanent residence. Under a socialist government, what would happen to those homeless people? I mean, what's happening now is certainly kind of controversial. Some of them are being dragged off to hospitals and given medication they say they don't want. Others are being put in shelters they say they don't want to go to. How would socialists deal with something like that?
The first thing I think you'd do if you wanted to address the homeless problem in any sort of serious way, I mean, a range of measures. First of all, raise the minimum wage. A great percent of the people who are homeless work full-time. It's a myth that most of them are people who come out of some sort of institutions who can't care for themselves or don't want to hold down a job. Many of them work and still can't pay for housing. You raise the minimum wage. I mean, I think there are a range of questions, I would say, healthcare, education, and housing, prominent among them, where under the type of government we would like to see, basic human needs would be guaranteed, certainly to a greater extent than they are now, and in many ways, fully. I don't think that, access to food and to shelter and to education should be dependent on your wealth, on your social standing, on your race, on your, gender. Questions like this. These I think should be seen as basic human needs. And already, it's not just the kind of dream society that could address these questions better. In most Western European societies that have a more developed welfare state, many these problems are not nearly as severe. There are still, there are difficulties, but not nearly as severe as they are in the United States. I mean, more than half of the black children in the United States are in poverty. The numbers are just outrageous. And despite the kind of economic recovery that President Reagan speaks about all the time, the numbers of people in poverty or close to the poverty line, so really insecure, haven't really dropped.
Okay, when we come back, we will be taking phone calls. Our number is 632-6901. If you have any questions for these two members of the Democratic Socialists of America, maybe your only chance ever to ask questions of someone from this organization, unless you somehow get on the Donahue Show and they have a topic like that. How many times are you able to address people, to have forums? I mean, is it often enough?
We certainly have tried to get the word out in various ways, and I and a couple other people on the national staff travel all over the country talking to folks, for me on campuses and for other people in the organization in communities at churches or local meetings, trying to discuss socialism with people and politics in their own communities.
Okay. Well, all right, when we get back, we will get to some of these calls. 632-6901, if you have any questions for Elisa McBride or Bill Spencer, both of the Democratic Socialists of America, and we'll be back right after this.
Fourth annual Bob Marley Day, a two-day event. Friday, February 5th, and Saturday, February 6th, 1988.
At the State University of New York in Stony Brook in the Student Union Building.
On Friday, February 5th, the event kicks off from 12 noon and will go to 6 p.m. This event is a Black History Month presentation.
So join us for a Reggae Weekend.
I don't want to wait.
Okay, that's coming up February 5th and 6th, the 4th annual Bob Marley Day. Bob Marley Day, 1988. And we had a couple of calls. They both went away. What's going on here? 632-6901 is our phone number, area code 516-632-6901. Call us up and tell us how you feel about the whole political system, whether it's fair or not, if socialists and communists and all kinds of other people should have candidates and whether they should win and whether it's all fair. And one thing I want to talk about that these folks who are up here tonight have done, you've endorsed a political candidate who's somewhat controversial, and of course that is Jesse Jackson. Maybe you'd like to go into why Jesse Jackson, and have you had any kind of disagreement about him, any bad feelings, good feelings?
Well, certainly we have a range of opinions within the organization, and that's one thing that we feel pretty strongly about, that we're a decentralized organization which takes non-binding votes on things like who to endorse. It was actually a vote that was almost unanimous of the National Convention in December to endorse Jackson, but certainly there are members of the organization working for other candidates. There are members of the organization who don't work for any candidate at all. There are many members of the organization, however, who believe that Jesse Jackson is speaking about issues and about a politics that is attempting to make fundamental criticisms and endorse fundamental changes for the U.S. political system. And that's, in some ways, you know, the most basic thing that we hold in common with him, that he certainly doesn't call himself a socialist, but we hold many opinions and positions in common with Jackson. And indeed, he's also working with many of the people that we've attempted to work with in coalitions of various kinds to change particular aspects of the U.S. political system. Jackson is speaking of issues that concern people of color in this country, that concern labor in this country, that concern working people, that concern women, that concern gays and lesbians, that he's been up front on so many of the social issues that we've been concerned about. He was the only candidate to speak at the Gay and Lesbian March on Washington that took place in the fall of 87. He was the only candidate that came out to Minnesota, where I was living last year, and spoke to the workers who were striking at the Hormel plant. You know, he's been out front on so many of these struggles that people have waged around various social issues. I think that's really important, and one of the major reasons why we've worked with him on many of these struggles, and that we're working with him in this attempt.
Now, a lot of people say he's racist. What do you think about that kind of accusation, that he's anti-Semitic and has said all kinds of other things that have been offensive to certain groups?
Well, certainly there's been a lot of discussion around the Reverend Jackson and remarks he's made over the years. And as he says himself, he's around the remarks where he referred to New York as Hymietown, he apologized for those remarks. And around the remarks that Minister Farrakhan made, Reverend Jackson said that that they were reprehensible remarks and said that he wouldn't take Mr. Farrakhan's support in this election. I don't think none of us would argue that Jesse Jackson is a perfect servant, of the public, that he's he's going to save the country, that he's a returned saint or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he said that himself. I mean, the thing that I've been impressed with when in looking specifically at the question around relationships with the Jewish community is his constant attempt to make those relations better. And he said there's been a history of tension between black and Jewish communities in this country, although they've often worked together in civil rights questions and so forth. And Reverend Jackson's really been, I mean, he's been there going into the schools where there are tensions and trying to draw people from different communities together, trying to get them to understand their problems in a way that they can work together on them instead of work against each other. He's engaged in some very long, sometimes difficult dialogue with Jewish leaders. And it hasn't been easy for both sides of that formula. But I think it's, that he's certainly shown a personal commitment to grow in those ways. One of the difficulties people have with Reverend Jackson is, for example, he's one of the only candidates that addresses other issues in the Middle East in a serious way.
Such as?
He's quite, I mean, the Arab American community, in some of its better organized political organizations and so forth, has been very, you know, vigorously in support of his campaign, and he's spoken out about the importance of reaching a settlement in the Middle East that, you know, that respects the different parties involved in the conflict there and isn't just based on the projection of military force in the Persian Gulf or in the Mediterranean. And that sort of thing has made some people uneasy. But it's also brought in a whole community that in many ways was isolated in American politics. That's what I see Jackson doing over and over again.
Do you see it as possibly, by bringing people who are isolated out into the open again, do you see more conflicts on the horizon now?
I don't know whether there will be this time. You know, he's got a bit more of a professional campaign manager than he had the last time, and he's also been through this experience once before. I imagine there'll be some hitches. You know, in many of the places where he's running his campaign, he doesn't do it with well-paid, slick professionals, but he does it with people who are volunteers, you know, who work in many of the struggles that he's been supportive of, and they do it on their own time. You know, they work very late at night. And like you said, he's bringing people into the political system that haven't always been there, haven't always learned, you know, to walk in step and hold their tongue when they get upset. So there may be, you know, there may be some other flacks or incidents. But as far as Mr. Jackson himself goes, you know, he's been through this once before. I think he's made very clear that he doesn't see his candidacy as a protest movement, but is serious about addressing the central issues of concern to a majority of the American people, and he wants to bring those questions, you know, right onto the political, onto the table for discussion.
Well, how is he being met by, say, the media in general, by the American people?
I think he's really gotten short shrift from the media. I think it's been quite apparent that, especially when Hart was out of the race, when Jackson was number one in the polls, that he was certainly not given the sort of attention that the front runner is traditionally given from the press. And there have been all sorts of articles which bash him for one thing and then bash him for another. And the latest thing is that, you know, he's going for the mainstream and it's suddenly a criticism, you know, that he's become too right-wing for everyone after people were upset by the fundamental criticisms that he was making. You know, that there's this attempt to just undercut him for whatever reason that I've seen in everything from right-wing papers to supposedly left-wing or middle-of-the-road journals like the New York Times. You know, that they certainly did not give him the sort of attention that is generally given to a leading candidate, and that he's often been seen as sort of an anomaly, something that is an interesting thing that we have a black candidate, but not taken seriously as at least a significant player in the Democratic National Convention, if not a potential candidate for the Democratic Party.
Now, why is that? I mean, isn't it kind of going against what all this is all about, to not take someone seriously who's raising the issues? I mean, why would the media likes conflicts. The media likes to bring things out into the open and make things up that don't exist sometimes, but why would they not do this in his case?
I think partly people don't expect that Jackson can win. You know, I mean, if you talk to Jackson himself, he'll say, he doesn't say, you know, I'm the best candidate, therefore I should win. He says that, but he also goes through the numbers, and he goes through the numbers of delegates he thinks he can win. And he puts together, you know, a pretty good package that it doesn't look unreasonable. I mean, I think he's going to do quite well. But people in the media from the beginning have, you know, seen him as a sort of a protest candidate rather than a serious candidate. I think they probably also have some difficulty covering a candidate who works in a different way from most people. You know, we mentioned before that a lot of the work on the campaign is done by a volunteer staff or by people that are really overtaxed. He doesn't have as much money as other folks. I think it's a little bit hard to pin him down sometimes. You know, he's always rushing off from event to event. There were three stories recently that were real interesting for me, at least in the coverage of Jackson. The first was a non-story, which is often the most interesting type, something that didn't make it into the national press. It was a poll released recently where Jackson now wins a plurality, not a majority, but a plurality of Southern white farmers. So among Democratic candidates for president, Jackson favored among Southern white farmers. Seems very interesting, and to go against, you know, some of the assumptions that we might have, and yet I didn't see much play about it in the national press.
Southern white farmers,
yeah,
prefer,
mm-hmm,
Jesse Jackson.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
I think he's done a lot of work there. I mean, I think he's done a lot of work in the South. He's addressed some of the issues that questions that these people have, questions around, you know, what agribusinesses are doing, around government programs. And also there's been a lot of growth in the South over race questions in the last 20 years. And, you know, Jackson's one of the people that's been involved in that. Another story that came up, Washington Post reported about 3 days ago about the what they called populist rhetoric of several of the Democratic candidates. And they went through several examples. And they mentioned Jackson once, only about four words, I think, saying that he had some mildly class-conscious rhetoric in his campaign. It was clear from reading the article that they thought that Jackson, being out front, had pushed other candidates to take more, you know, stronger positions, but then they focused on the positions the other candidates took, and they didn't talk about what Jackson was saying.
Okay, looks like we have a call. 632-6901, area code 516. Give us a call. And USP, you're on...
What do you want to talk about?
Hello?
Hello?
You're on the air.
My name is Paul. I've come across some DSA activists before. I'm an activist at SUNY Binghamton. And I do a lot of work there in a anti-nuclear group up there, a peace group. And even Jackson, and this is the thing I don't quite understand, even Jackson, you know, says, well, you know, we want to be strong on defense, and we have to be serious about national security. Isn't that kind of stuff just, you know, kind of ultimately all, aren't they all saying the same thing, even Jackson, on that? I'm just curious about that.
Okay, you want to address that?
Well, I think that Jackson is attempting to change some of the terms of debate on international issues, and one thing I recall from the 84 campaign is that Jackson was one of the first candidates. You know, now everybody loves Gorbachev, but Jackson was one of the first public figures in the U.S. who was making an attempt to have dialogue with him, and he met with him in Geneva during the peace talks at one point. And, you know, from actions like that to positions on issues in Central America and parts of the Third World, I think Jackson is certainly taking a far different position than Reagan is. And that's one fundamental difference that it's important to point out, that, you know, first of all, we want to challenge Reagan and the Republicans on some of this stuff. And then we also want to look to the Democrats and what their different positions are and what the distinctions are among them. You know, I do think that Jackson has, on the debates at least, I haven't seen him always articulating what his fundamental understandings of some of these issues are. But certainly if you look at his positions and the official positions he's taking on issues like Central America, then he's far to the left of Reagan and still to the left of many of the other candidates.
I think one of the things that Jackson says is that we need a better guided foreign policy instead of more guided missiles. I mean, he's actually, you know, addressed some of these questions very directly. He's talked about a 20% cut in the defense budget. He's looked at some of the regional conflicts that have been the site of, you know, U.S. involvement in the Middle East and Central America, and tried to look at a more comprehensive solution. He's understood, I think, better than any of the other candidates, that it's not only a question of the U.S. military, how many tanks we have, how many planes we have, but what our relations with the rest of the world are. He's talked about, for example, a plan to create a new capital fund for third world development projects. He's talked about debt relief. He's talked about a halt to the International Monetary Fund's austerity programs. He's talked about a code of conduct for American multinational corporations. a whole range of democratic development strategies for the third world that would address the kinds of deprivation and political disenfranchisement you have in many of those countries that are at the root of conflicts. And often, you know, what you see in the United States, we sort of watch these things going on, and our American corporations are often very much involved. Conflicts within a society where there's, you know, enormous deprivation, even in an era of economic growth, you know, leads to sometimes political struggle, sometimes military struggle, and then the U.S. comes in later and tries to clean up. I think that Jackson is trying to look at the root causes of some of those regional conflicts and try to realign our relations with the rest of the world so we don't have to rely on military might.
Yeah, but I, even what I said, I mean, about a 20% cut in the military budget, I mean, there's no doubt that that's, like, you know, it's better than anybody else says, but 20% of the current military budget is still an enormous amount of money, and it doesn't challenge the fact that, I mean, that this is all crazy, and that if you have any nuclear weapons at all, we're probably all going to die before the next, you know, 20 years. I mean, how, if he's not willing to say that the military-industrial complex is the enemy, and, you know, sort of, like, disarm it, and how will he ever be able to actually do anything?
Well, I mean, one thing I think about Jackson is that he's been one of the few candidates willing to challenge corporations. You're talking about the military-industrial complex. I think that Jackson has been one of the few who is willing to go beyond what's been acceptable in the U.S. political debate and say that corporations are to blame for a whole host of problems that we have in the U.S., both economically and politically, that, you know, workers are losing jobs, that we're losing out in the international economy, that Jackson says we have to look to the corporations when we lay the blame here, not necessarily to the deficit or to Japanese workers or to whatever scapegoat is currently being used, that Jackson is willing to put the blame on the corporations for some of that stuff. So I think he goes much farther than other candidates have on some of the stuff you're talking about.
Thanks for calling, and that's... go to our next call. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering about Jackson, but also about your organization, what you do on feminist issues, and I mean current legislation and working in the Democratic Party, but also what your theories or principles are on feminism, and what, I mean, do you have a socialist analysis of feminism or you know, and I'm also wondering a little bit about Jackson and what he means for women, you know, what he means for feminist issues.
Okay, before these folks in the Democratic Socialists of America answer that question, let me just tell you, you're tuned to WUSB in Stony Brook, and our phone number is 632-6901. Now, would you like to address that question?
Well, since I'm the woman, I'm not going to answer that question. I think I'm going to let Bill take a shot at this one.
As you said, the organizations involved in work around a whole range of issues of concern to women that include legislation, whether it's child care issues or health care issues and so forth. But we don't do all of our work in the Democratic Party. We're also active in many of the movements outside of the party, and you know, the women's movement is one of those areas. There's a long history. Many of the people that are active in the organization came out of the New Left in, you know, in the 1960s and 70s when the women's movement took on its, you know, its started its current phase and have been active throughout. I mean, we're certainly... What are some of your specific questions? Do you have a question about how we view a particular issue or the kinds of organizing that people are involved in?
Well, I'm interested in the kind of organizing that you do if you support any current legislation, you know, or if you have ideas about what feminism or feminist country America should be, you know, what you were talking about the family before. I'm wondering what, you know, if you have any visions of feminism that are different maybe from what a lot of us have heard Democrats talk about.
Well, I mean, I think one thing about a socialist analysis that complements a feminist analysis is to understand some of the ways in which sexism is a very, it's a very significant and phenomenon in our society that runs deep. You know, you're not going to get rid of it by passing legislation or by having equal numbers of women running corporations or whatever kind of equal opportunity attempts are made to have women participate in surface ways in U.S. politics. That, you know, there are certain pieces of legislation which impact on women, particularly when you get into economic issues. And that's a link that we would attempt to make, that you have to look at the ways in which women are affected specifically by economic problems in the U.S. For example, the fact that, you know, poverty is a problem for a large number of Americans, and certainly it cuts across all types of categories, but that women and children are the bulk of the poor, and that women, and part of this is because women are paid 60% of what men are paid when you look at the aggregate numbers, that women have been, their work has been undervalued, that they've been underpaid, that they're more likely to be in service sector, minimum wage jobs, and you need to look at the ways in which the economic system affects women, you know, in harmful ways. So there is legislation that has been, you know, on... that has been raised, which has been attempting to address these concerns, and certainly we support things like raising the minimum wage, as we said before, child care legislation, which would make a significant difference for all women, and low-income women in particular, and, you know, we don't necessarily write such legislation or attempt to formulate it, but we certainly support it, and we also want to look at the whole range of ways in society in which women are oppressed, and root out oppression by looking at its, you know, all the structures of oppression, all the institutions in our society which reflect the oppression of women, that it's not an easy task, and that we have to look at it pretty systematically to understand it.
Yeah, the sort of narrow example, some recent state surveys in Washington, Vermont, California, and Massachusetts found that between one-third and two-thirds of the single unemployed mothers were not working or participating in job training because they couldn't find adequate child care. So that's the kind of question when we talked before about the minimum guarantees of a, you know, advanced welfare state, a social democratic system. Those types of things would be guaranteed, and that would free people up economically. I think that, you know, those kinds of things are important, but feminism, I mean, the insights brought by the feminist movement and the struggles that were carried on by women weren't just to get equal access to some of these things. You know, it's not just a matter of letting more women become rich lawyers or be corporate heads or whatever. It brought a very fundamental critique about the relations between people in society, and a society that's based on the pursuit of profit and of power and of status, instead of one that was based on the meeting of people's needs, whether it's, you know, material needs, the need for an environment in which you can develop yourself, and an environment of security and mutuality. So when I think about you know, what kind of work we do that's related to the feminist movement, or the impact of feminist politics on a wider range of questions, I think it's important to say it's not just a matter of, you know, winning access for women to do the same bad things that men often do when they get power in this kind of society.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, thanks for calling. 632-6901, that's our telephone number, and I kind of like to hear from some people that are, I guess, a bit more conservative in nature, because... after all, they're the ones that you really should be talking to, because I mean, you get together with groups of people, and you're having a conference now. Which how often do you have these conferences?
Yeah, we're having a meeting now of some members of the youth section, which happens every couple months. We get together to talk, to make decisions, and to discuss what we should be working on within our youth section.
Now, you have these meetings, and you talk to people that are pretty much in agreement with what you have to say, but how often do you get to talk to the people that don't agree with what you say, where you have a chance to present your platform and convince people already. Care to address?
Well, I stand up on the subway every morning and give a big speech about all these things. I mean, the types of meeting, the meeting that's going on this weekend is to lay out strategies and plan our work for the future. And then, like Elisa said, she's riding on the bus around campuses, you know, all year long. And Michael Harrington, one of our national co-chairs, has a radio spot on National Public Radio. Barbara Ehrenreich, an author from around here, from Syosset on Long Island, you know, addressing people, speaking, writing a regular column for several newspapers. And many of our local groups are, you know, out there talking to the folks that they're working with. So we don't, you know, we certainly don't seek in isolation and take advantage or, you know, make use of any public forum that we get. And if someone wants us to come talk to a class in school or a community organization, we can, you know, arrange something to have somebody stop by. That'd be great.
Let's go to our next call, and good evening. You're on the air.
Hello, Amar.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, how you doing? Yeah, I noticed your phone call has got a lot... Your people on the show got a lot of words to say, but, I mean, it comes down to one basic fact. Why don't they just go to the Soviet Union and live there? I mean, you know, they want to, like, take away our rights as Americans. They want to, like, really mess us up. You know, why don't they just go back to the Soviet Union?
Okay, this is the kind of call I was waiting for. Go to it. Let's hear your response to this kind of reaction, because this is the kind of reaction that I'm sure you get quite a bit of.
Sure. I mean, and it's frankly a little bit hard to understand. I mean, I certainly don't have too many roots in the Soviet Union. I know how I would go back to the Soviet Union. I'm quite young. I haven't yet had an opportunity to visit. And, you know, I don't even know who I'd stay with if I went to the Soviet Union. I think that there's this fundamental misunderstanding that a socialist is necessarily someone either from the Soviet Union or in support of the Soviet Union. And this is what we were talking about earlier in terms of the Donahue Show and the assumption that communists and socialists were, you know, that there's no difference between them. Certainly, there are some points of agreement, but we have a fundamental critique of the centralized nature, the bureaucracy, the elitism of the Soviet system, that, you know, its solution to capitalism was to set up a different kind of centralized elitist structure, which, you know, maybe takes care of people's fundamental needs better than we do in the U.S. And we could, you know, point to some examples of things which the Soviet Union has accomplished. On the other hand, certainly there is not the sort of participation in the political system that democratic socialists are looking for. We're talking about people taking control of their lives, people taking part in political debate and political discussion and economic and, you know, all sorts of resources that we have in society that that sharing the wealth, redistributing wealth, economic democracy. This is not the situation in the Soviet Union currently, and we make the same sort of criticisms there that we would make of the U.S. government. You know, we're certainly not blind to the problems in the Soviet Union, and we want to look to something different, not to a model that some other country has put in place.
I'd like to ask, I guess you sort of just answered that, is there any country that you do look at that has done positive things? I mean, you're saying you don't support the Soviet Union. How about Red China? Are they doing any better? Is any country making inroads in this kind of thing?
Well, there's a whole, you know, every country has to create its own political direction. I mean, we mentioned several times many of the advanced welfare states in Western Europe that do make some guarantees around some fundamental needs that I think do it in a way that would be admirable here. Certainly, you know, the 30 million Americans, U.S. citizens, who don't have any access to health care because they can't afford it, might be pleased to know that if they, you know, were growing up in most of Western Europe and they were seriously ill, they could see a doctor. You know, on the other hand, like Elisa said, there's those in those countries, the parties that espouse the same kinds of values and programs that we do are also looking for ways to move beyond where they are. I mean, I think there are some guarantees that you see in the northern European countries, in Norway, Finland, Sweden, in West Germany to some extent, some measures in France and England, and even things closer to home in Canada, where, you know, where labor organizations, for example, are stronger and can put up a stronger defense for working people, where health care guarantees are stronger. These are things that we'd like to work for, but we don't, there's no society that fully captures my vision of a perfect world.
I'd like to ask the caller if he has any feelings on health care. Should that be provided by the government? Should that be something an individual takes care of?
People work every day. People should pay for health care. That's the whole deal. Who else is going to pay for health care in the United States?
The way, when you look at a country like Sweden and compare the numbers, not only on indexes of infant mortality and life expectancy and numbers of days spent in hospitals and your kind of clinical measures of the provision of adequate health care, but even in terms of total cost, the Swedes spend less per person as a country than the United States spends on health care. We spend it privately here, and like I said, there are about 30 million Americans that don't get any of it. But in a country like Sweden, where it comes out of contributions that are made through taxes, from your employer, guarantees by the state, they have actually spend less as a society because it's organized in a more rational way.
Yeah, and I'd also like to point out that we wouldn't necessarily ask you to pay for everyone's health care. We're not going to try and take money from people, the point of socialism or democratic socialism is not necessarily to steal money away from the people who have attempted to, make a better life for themselves. It's to take money from the people who are absolutely disgustingly wealthy in this country. And we know that there are some folks like that out there who are not taxed. The tax system that we have has all these loopholes that allow people to basically get by without paying anything into the public welfare. A lot of us are taxed, and we're taxed too much. But some people aren't taxed at all. And those people should contribute to health care system in this country that will help meet the needs of those who can't pay anything.
I'd like to butt in for a second here and just ask, now that you've mentioned this about certain people that aren't taxed, how about organizations, namely religious organizations that aren't taxed? Is that fair? Should religious groups have to pay taxes like everyone else, like all other businesses, or what?
I'm a defender of the separation of church and state and actually don't know some of the intricate details of tax law for churches. Certainly some of the religious organizations in the country are very wealthy.
Does the DSA pay taxes?
The people who work there certainly pay their income taxes. I like to put the problem in a different way.
I don't think the DSA is a business, is it?
No, DSA is not a business.
You see, you take something like Oral Roberts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that guy is making money. Hand over fist, he is making money. He's got a university named after him. He owns it. He runs it. It's a business. That's what concerns me when I see such large businesses with their toll-free numbers and their TV channels, and they don't pay a penny in taxes. That's something that a lot of money is being thrown away there. It rivals the Defense Department, I think.
Oh, I don't know if it's quite that bad or quite that dangerous.
Morally, anyway.
It might be. Yeah, it might be. I think you certainly don't want to see abuse of the tax codes that protect religious organizations from taxation, used for political purposes and so forth. But, I'll also want to be very careful about using those kinds of things to limit freedom of expression. It's certainly not something that we're for. I'd sort of like to put the problem in a different way. First, a personal experience. I spent a good deal of my growing up years in New Hampshire, northern New Hampshire, an economically depressed area. Many of the people that I grew up with, went to high school with, never went to the dentist. They couldn't afford it. People who worked hard, often two jobs, but they couldn't afford any kind of, a health care system. They would only go to the dentist in order to have teeth pulled when a problem had gotten so bad they'd have it extracted. And that's a ridiculous way, an expensive way, a painful way, a morally reprehensible way to deal with health care. And these people weren't people who were lazy, people who worked hard and all that sort of stuff. I don't look at it as a matter of, one individual has a given amount of money, and for another individual to get some sort of services, you've got to take it from the first individual. Certainly there are large companies that don't pay their share of taxes, most of the wealth that's created in a country like this is one that, you know, it's wealth that's created in some sort of social way. People work together to make goods, you know, to ship them around. People work together to come up with the idea of a good. You know, people work together to create services. That's the kind of wealth, you know, the kinds of resources that are generated by a society in a very social way. And certainly someone may own the title to a factory or own the right under this system to the profits that are made by selling the goods that come out of there. But there's a whole history of, you know, entire communities often that make some sort of contribution to that wealth. And just like that wealth is created socially, so I think there are some very fundamental human needs that should be guaranteed socially.
Does our caller have any final comment?
Yeah, this is the deal. If they wouldn't be able to say that stuff in the Soviet Union, let them go back to the Soviet Union, man. Let them pay taxes, man. Goodbye.
Okay, well.
Actually, I grew up in Utah. I was born in Utah, and you know, maybe you think Mormons are strange too, just like you might think communists are strange. I mean, it's true, as we said, you know, I said before, we think that freedom, the freedoms of speech that you have in this country, is very important. It's absolutely crucial. We wouldn't want to see it restricted in any way. And in any country where you see that restricted, that's a problem. And you know, you would have difficulties saying lots of things in lots of different countries around the world. The Soviet Union's not the only one. The head of the Human Rights Commission in Guatemala met with the president, the Verification Commission, which was traveling through Central America, met with them about a week ago and told them about human rights abuses in that country, and he was killed yesterday. It's not a defense of the Soviet Union. That's not the only place where you've got some pretty outrageous things going on.
632-6901 is our telephone number, area code 516-632-6901, and we'll be back right after this.
Martin Luther King had a dream that must live in all of us if we and our children are to survive. This is Arthur Ashe. On January 18th, we celebrate Dr. King's birthday as a national holiday. Together, we will share Dr. King's message, loving, not hating, showing understanding, not anger, making peace, not war. Together, we will make Dr. King's dream live.
And we're back. It's 21 minutes after 11 o'clock, and we're on until 12, talking to Lisa McBride and Bill Spencer, both of the Democratic Socialists of America. And we'd like to hear from you, our typical Long Islanders out there, or not-so-typical Long Islanders, people from Connecticut, perhaps. Area code 516-632-6901. Give us a call, and with your comments or questions about socialism, about the political system, about current events, all that kind of thing. If you have any kind of comment, please give us a call, 632-6901. And we were mentioning human rights abuses in various places in the world. Now, I sense that there are many different places where there are human rights abuses, and groups like the Democratic Socialists and the Communist Party, perhaps I'm wrong, but do I sense a kind of impatience with the amount of time spent on human rights abuses in the Soviet Union? Do you think perhaps, as you said, where there are other places in the world that deserve attention, maybe we're spending too much time just going over the same ground in the Soviet Union?
I think the main point to make there is not, you know, whether we're protesting the Soviet Union too much. I think that we do have to point out human rights abuses in the Soviet Union, and certainly we've attempted to do that in the essay. But I think one thing that we want to do is not only look at, the international situation and be aware of examples like Bill gave of human rights abuses in other parts of the world, which we often don't know enough about. I mean, I think in general, I feel like compared to many other people in other parts of the world, I'm quite ignorant of not only what's going on in the U.S., but also in other countries. You know, I feel like often people from other countries, students from other countries will know more than I do about the U.S. political situation. And I think we're, you know, in general, unfortunately ignorant of not only human rights abuses but other sorts of political issues going on in other countries, and indeed in our own country. You know, we don't even look in our own backyard and see human rights abuses.
Okay, what kind of a human rights abuse would take place in this country? That's something that's a a point of discussion among many people. Are there human rights abuses in the United States?
I would say no. Oh, I would say that, you know, there's been a lot of discussion of a resurgence of racist violence on campuses all over the U.S. I mean, I think that's a human rights abuse that we should be paying attention to. And fortunately, the press did pick that up to some extent, and there has been some discussion of it. But certainly people aren't as aware of it as they could be, that often what you get is an incredulous response of, you know, oh, no, you know, that doesn't happen in the U.S. We're beyond that. There is economic violence in the U.S. I think that homeless people on the street in New York City freezing in the winter is a human rights abuse, and that we need to see these sorts of examples in our own country as in need of attention and not accept them as, you know, inevitable the way that we often do.
I see. Can you name another part of the world that perhaps we're not that familiar with, where there are things going on we should be concerned with, instead of always, like I said, the Soviet Union and you know, various iron bloc countries? Where else? We hear things from rightist regimes as well.
Mm-hmm. It goes back to some of the questions you were asking about what the press in the United States likes to cover and why it likes to cover certain things. An example, when the Polish underground union Solidarity was subjected to martial law, as was the rest of Polish society in December 1981, there was a huge outcry in the press in the United States. Now, we supported Solidarity as democratic socialists here. I mean, they were arguing for worker management of the factories. They were arguing for the right to political dissent, and so forth. And so we were very much encouraged by what they did, and we were very glad that their efforts got a great deal of coverage in the United States. At the same time, you had repression and murder of some major labor leaders in Brazil, martial law in Turkey with a roundup, again, of opposition labor leaders, many of whom were tortured, and this was hardly mentioned anywhere. Again, it's not a matter of saying that the attention that was given to Solidarity and the people struggling for, you know, for political freedoms in Eastern Europe should be downplayed. But there was a blind spot in the American press. There's a very good book called The Real Terror Network, written by a guy named Edward Herman. And one of the things he does is he lists major public figures that you might have heard of, prominent political dissidents, especially in Eastern Europe, and how many times that they were mentioned prominently in the major national media. And then he goes through and talks about people in many other parts of the world, especially Latin America, the Far East, people who are equally prominent within their own societies, literary figures, academics, labor leaders, student leaders, who had faced the same types of either detention or, in many cases, torture and execution. And it was almost never mentioned in the United States. The real irony, as far as I'm concerned, and the thing that actually makes it rather disgusting, is that many of the regimes that are violating human rights, repressing people politically, that you don't read about in the American press, are regimes that are supported economically by the United States. El Salvador now is almost up there with Israel and Egypt in terms of the aid that it gets from the United States, something like $2 billion a year. And we provide police training for their military, and so forth. And, you know, 60,000 civilians have been killed in that country since the Civil War started in 1980. And most church organizations in El Salvador say that 85-90% of those people were killed by the government, by security forces, by the death squads, linked with the government, trained in the U.S., armed by the United States.
Things seem to have died down a bit, though, over there. I mean, are things getting better, or are we just not seeing what's going on?
Not as many people getting killed a month in El Salvador as there were in 1980, 81, 82. Although, I mean, that's one of the things that happens when you clear entire parts of the country out, when you lay to waste villages, and, you know, when you have hundreds of thousands of people going as refugees into other countries. Not as many people left to kill. In fact, the International Verification Commission that was reporting progress on the peace accord reported that El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras hadn't amnestied that many prisoners under the terms of the peace accord because they had a practice previously of killing prisoners, so there weren't many to be let out by amnesty. I mean, the situation in El Salvador is not as easily, you know, publicly brutal as it was in 1981 or 82, but there are still, you know, you hear reports almost every day, if you can find them, you know, the right ways through the American press, whether it's bombing of villages, you know, arrest of union leaders, killings of human rights leaders. And once again, the thing that's so frustrating from here is that our government plays a very large part in that.
Now, let's get back to the news item that came over the teletype only recently about President Ortega of Nicaragua lifting the state of emergency. What is that significant to people in this country? I mean, how should we look upon that? Is that an end to...
You know, they won't be able to use it against Ortega and the Sandinistas the way they have in the past, but there's a policy and a whole attitude locked into place in the Reagan administration about Nicaragua, a myopia that this small country attempting the struggle out of centuries of oppression is going to have to fight the entire economic and political force of the U.S. in any attempt to change the system of government that they have or try and pull itself out of a repressive regime that they've been struggling against for years. And, you know, that I don't think that Reagan is going to change his position because of what Ortega has done. I do think it indicates... some of the positive nature of the process that's going on among the presence of the Central American nations, and that we should look to that process for both an understanding of what's going on in Central America and also for our attitude and what we in the U.S. should be doing in order to help the situation there. I think Reagan has been incredibly disrespectful of that process and will continue to be.
How about the summit? Is that leading us anywhere? Should Reagan be given some kind of credit for bringing us to a stage where we can actually address some of the issues that keep all the many different sides apart?
You mean the summit with the Soviet Union?
The summit with the Soviet Union. Yeah, I see that as related to Nicaragua because obviously that's a major point of contention.
Yeah, I think certainly I'm glad that Mr. Gorbachev and Mr. Reagan signed the INF Treaty instead of not signing it or instead of deciding to build more, you know, intermediate-range nuclear forces. I don't think that many people have the illusion that this is going to be the end of the arms race. The treaty got rid of about 3% of the nuclear, I think, missiles or warheads. The missiles that were taken out on the U.S. side, I don't think ever should have been put there in the first place. They were the Euro missiles that were put in the early 1980s in many of the Western European countries, and that gave the United States the capacity to threaten, more threatening first strike capacity in Western Europe, set up a tripwire that was made it a very dangerous situation. I'm glad that he has, to some extent, moderated some of his views of the Soviet Union, although I don't think he has very much. Many people in the administration say they're willing to deal with the Soviets, but they don't trust them. That's okay. You can't expect, world affairs, the relations between nations aren't often based on trust, at least in this day and age. I'm glad to see him at least stepping back from some of the more ridiculous, statements that he was making earlier in his presidency about the evil empire. And
the
so
bombing will begin in 5 minutes.
Well, he's not being caught anymore. I don't think he's gotten a lot more careful about saying things off mic.
Yeah,
let's let Bill address that first question, too, about Central America.
I think that the Reagan administration will try to use the same type of logic, actually. They will say that the Euro missiles that we deployed in Western Europe after 1979 were sort of the bargaining chips. You know, every new weapon system is seen as a bargaining chip to get the Soviets to do something else. And I think they'll use a similar logic. They'll argue that the Contras in Nicaragua are a bargaining chip, that, you know, they are the pressure that has forced the Nicaraguan government to make the kinds of concessions that we heard about today. And so they will argue that, you know, the new ceasefire, possible ceasefire that may be negotiated, the end of state of emergency, they will argue this just shows the wisdom of backing the Contras. I think that really the situation, President Arias of Costa Rica addressed this quite, you know, in a very forthright way before he received his Nobel Prize. He said the difference between his views and the views of the Reagan administration was that President Arias sees the Contras as the problem and the Reagan administration sees them as the solution. In many ways, I think what the Central American peace plan has done is really the opposite of what the Reagan administration argues. The peace plan has held out the prospects for the end of the Contra war, a war that has, you know, killed or injured 25,000 Nicaraguan civilians, that's bled that country's economy, and a war that's you know, there's a war in almost every country in that region. There's been a large civilian toll in El Salvador and in Guatemala and Honduras. What the peace plan held out is the prospect to the end of those conflicts, and specifically to the end of funding for the Contras. And it's in that situation that the Nicaraguan government said, look, if we go forward with these discussions, if they go well, it can mean an end to the Contra war. And so we are willing to make some concessions that we wouldn't make under the state of war that we're in now. And I think it's, you know, it's the prospect of cutting off aid to the Contras that's made many of the Central American presidents move forward, even though, you know, many of them are very close American allies. President of El Salvador and Honduras in particular are very deeply reliant on the United States for economic and military aid. And yet, you know, they are involved in the discussions which call very clearly for an end to the funding of the Contras as a fundamental prerequisite for the success of the peace process.
So you think it'll pretty much be downplayed on the part of the Reagan administration or even dismissed?
Oh, sure. They'll call it a hoax. And I mean, what you have on the other side, you know, when you've got these discussions about a Nicaraguan military officer that releases military plans that have been public for, you know, for a long time, speeches that were made over and over again. I mean, you could get access to any of the Miranda disclosures or Humberto Ortega's speech at any point. They're released just before the last vote on Contra aid as major news, cover of the newspapers, private briefings with congressional swing voters and so forth. And yet what you'll have here, on, you know, you can just hear the State Department spokesperson right now saying that it's all a sham and a cover-up.
Okay, well, I'm going to shift gears a bit. Let me just get out the phone number one more time, as we only have a few more minutes left, and this may be our audience's last chance in a little while anyway to talk to people from the Democratic Socialists of America, find out their views on certain issues and topics and how their philosophy might affect you. 632-6901, that's our telephone number, area code 516-632-6901. And Monday is Martin Luther King Day, and I understand that there's going to be some kind of a rally in New York City, and I believe
that's
what,
right.
You know what exactly is going on. Why don't you tell
right.
us?
Well, there will be a rally starting from City Hall in New York City at 1 p.m. on Monday, and it's going to be a march to various halls of power in New York, national and local, and to Wall Street, in fact, as well as an economic hall of power, to try and put forth what Dr. King's message meant for the disempowered in the U.S. politically and economically, for people who have been oppressed for reasons of, you know, race or class or gender, that we need to fight against these structures that have been oppressive, and, you know, to reinforce that message and also to honor Dr. King and his memory. That'll be at 1 p.m. on Monday. tomorrow, or day after tomorrow, starting at City Hall in New York City.
Now, who is behind this demonstration? Is it one group in particular?
No, it's a coalition of groups, and we're a member of that coalition. That
What's the name of the coalition?
I don't think it's. I think it's just an ad hoc coalition that's put it together. And the information that I have came from Local 1199, a union in New York City.
Will they be doing any, shutting down the city again? I mean, I don't know if it's the same group that shut down the subways. Any plans for anything like that? Just
because it's meant to be a symbolic action of, you know, commemoration, but also political, you know, politically significant in terms of what Dr. King's message means for us today to continue the fight that he began. So, but I, as far as I know, there are no plans for civil disobedience or any sort of direct action.
Uh-huh. And that's supposed to start at 1 o'clock at City Hall, and I guess sort of fan out from there.
In Manhattan, right.
Okay, great. Are there any other kinds of events taking place on Martin Luther King Day that you know of or that the DSA is involved in?
I'm sure there are many around the country. I don't know of any of the details beyond New York.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we got the facts on that, because I was kind of mystified as to what exactly was going on. But okay, Lisa McBride and Bill Spencer, both of the DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, do you have any kind of projection into the future or parting comments you'd like to leave us with?
I had one thing I wanted to add to the discussion we had earlier, feminist politics. And that was that I wanted to just delve a little bit further into what it means to see the problem of oppression of women in U.S. society is running deep or as a structural problem. That, you know, women are currently, although, you know, we have achieved a certain opening up of society, the vote, women now vote, women have access to certain realms which they did not always have access to in the past. There's been some small attempt to reconstruct history and some of the supposed facts we have about U.S. politics or history or...
How do you mean reconstruct history?
Well, look at the ways in which women have participated that has been ignored in the past, that women's activities in the past have not been considered noteworthy or, you know, worthy of public attention. So there's been, you know, statements about women and people of color in this country being written out of the history books, that history is, to a large extent, the history of white men, white upper-class men in this country and certainly in other parts of the world as well, that we don't consider certain activities, certain roles, certain types of work to be significant. The fact that women's work has not always been considered work, that women have worked all their, you know, since the beginning of time in the home, but it's not considered work, that it's not compensated, that it's not considered significant in the same way that marketplace work is considered significant. But these are examples of the deep-running oppression of women. But, you know, some of this stuff is nominally opening up now. But we still see the exclusion of women from various, you know, bastions of power, from the sort of clubs that, who's the current Supreme Court nominee that, you know, we've come to after all this time?
Kennedy,
belonging to clubs which were male only, and which he admitted were politically significant groupings that he considered important to belong to, that they excluded everyone but white men, and that you still find very few women in the Congress or in state legislatures or in corporations. However, although we see these examples of exclusion of women, the answer to these problems is not just to inject women into these structures. You know, an example would be a women's conference I went to when I was in college, where they told us, you know, you can have it all. You women today, you can be everything. You can be mothers. You can have jobs. You can be corporate heads. You know, you should be working for Eastman Kodak. They want women. You know, you can do it. You're all prepared to take power in the society. And I remember standing up and objecting to this on the basis that the answer to having been oppressed in society is not to try and get in a position so that you can be part of the oppressor class. It's to try and look at the fundamental structures of oppression and say, why do we have systems in which a corporation like Eastman Kodak can extract, you know, the sort of resources that we have in society and, you know, control a large number of those resources that they don't pay the sort of taxes that they should be paying, that they contribute to oppression in South Africa, that they're doing all sorts of things which I consider to be violations of human rights, if you want to use that terminology, that I personally don't want to participate in that I want to be critical of what they're doing on a whole variety of issues. And in fact, the whole idea that you could have a group of people supposedly earning money which is not their own, but should be shared among the people who do the work which produces that wealth or those resources. You know, that they're extracting all these things from people who do the work to produce them and contributing to this very unequal distribution of wealth and resources in the U.S., that we need to look at that whole structure rather than just trying to have women participate in it or whatever group you want to talk about. So, you know, just to clarify some of that discussion. The other thing I wanted to add before we leave here was just to get back to the issues around Jesse Jackson's candidacy a little bit. I think that I wanted to say earlier that I think Jackson is a populist candidate in the way that Bill brought up, that one thing that he's doing is speaking to a wide range of people, southern white farmers, as Bill pointed out, people who have not always participated in the U.S. political system. As I pointed out, half of the eligible voting participation doesn't take part in U.S. national elections. He's reaching out to these people and saying, there is a potential for change. There is somebody who could speak to your needs. And he's having quite a bit of success, you know, despite the barriers that he's confronted with. And one of the good examples is farmers who are incredibly discontent with the U.S. economic system right now, and they're looking for alternatives. I mean, they're seeing the ways in which banks, as a centralized, you know, a center of power in the society, have really manipulated them, taken advantage of them, and have control over financial resources in this country and are using them very badly, that farmers are protesting that sort of system. And that Jackson is one of the few candidates who's proposing real alternatives to that and speaking to people in terms of alternatives that will mean a difference in their lives. You know, I think that's a real important thing, and I think that's one of the fundamental messages that we would want to get across as democratic socialists, that that's what we're talking about, trying to work on solutions, work toward solutions that meet people's needs and that do so in a decentralized manner, that you look to communities and say, what are the needs in this community? And how can the people in this community work towards solutions together and with the cooperation of the government, not the control of the government, but with certain guarantees from the government, certain resources from the government?
Bill, any parting remarks?
Oh, just a few. You know, we talked earlier about how most people don't have a sense of the legitimacy of a socialist point of view in American politics, and it's interesting because there's a socialists have a very long and very proud history of, you know, active participation in the kinds of struggles that have won the fundamental political and civil liberties that we cherish so much and that we talk about as being at the center of the American political system. The you know, expansion of the electorate, the kinds of, you know, guarantees, social provision guarantees that we talked about earlier, and, you know, even through, as the decades wore on, the struggles around to limit the most egregious actions of corporate employers or the most egregious actions of a large and sometimes coercive state. I mean, socialists have been involved in many of these struggles, whether it's, you know, for voting rights, human rights, you know, women's rights, so forth, and we're very proud of that tradition. So while there are not many public forums where you will see socialists get up on the subway unless you happen to catch me in the morning, you know, it's not because
I thought you were kidding. You really do get up on the subway?
No, not very often. Sometimes I hand out literature. You know, it's if you don't see us piping up all the time, it's certainly not because we're, you know, we aren't proud of the history of the kinds of, you know, work that socialists have done. And when you look around the country at some of the fundamental problems faced by the society, and I think that the questions that we're asking and the types of solutions we're talking about are the only questions and the only solutions that are really sufficient to the problems. Now you look at the, you know, the kinds of money that is wasted, $1 trillion evaporated, lost. Who knows where it went on the day that Wall Street crashed? I mean, it's, you know, it's absurd the way this society decides to invest its money, what it, you know, decides is useful to produce, how it sells them. When you've got a country whose foreign policy is set secretly, you know, privately, that's carried out in ways that no one knows about, often illegally, no accountability to the public, then I think you're in a very severe situation, and some basic questions have to be asked in the most central public institutions of our life, you know, in the churches, in the unions, in the schools. We're trying to help ask those questions about our domestic political situation, our domestic economic and social situation, and about our foreign policies. So if you're not hearing that much from us, or you don't see us doing our work out there, it's not because we're not out there. We are struggling on many of these questions, and I think in a way that's the only way that's sufficient to some of these problems. Really, the kind of society that we look forward to, the vision that helps, you know, maintain us as we do this difficult work is animated by some very simple principles in many ways. You know, one where relations between people are more conscious, that people take more direct direction over their life, they discuss it, they debate it, and they move forward in ways that everyone understands, where relations between people are more caring, they're not just based on money or on profit, but also based around the meeting of human needs, and where a society and its life is more considered. It looks at the, you know, you look at the long-term impact of the kinds of things you're doing in the economy, on its impact on the world around you and the world that will be there for future generations. So in many ways, you know, it's a tradition we're proud of, and it's very simple, I think, understandable to most people.
How can the listeners get a hold of you folks? Address, phone number, or anything like that?
We're based in New York City. We have our national office there. And the phone number is 212-962-0390. So you can contact us there anytime. We have a small but dedicated national staff that is there many hours of the day. And we have local chapters all over the country. And you could probably find out where they're at by, you know, checking with political organizations in your local community, or maybe they're even in the phone book, the Democratic Socialists of America. They go by, no matter where they are, the Central Kentucky Democratic Socialists of America, the East Bay Democratic Socialists of America. We're everywhere.
It must be a fun group to be in, the Central Kentucky group there. What's your address, in case people want to write?
15 Dutch Street, Suite 500, in New York, New York 10038.
Okay.
And the phone number, one more time, is 212-962-0390.
And what is next on your agenda? Where do you go from here?
Well, I'm off to be discussing a conference that we're putting on in February with some other of my comrades in the youth section, and then I'm going to be on the road to campuses all over the Northeast, trying to do some outreach for this conference, which is going to be February 12th through 14th in New York City. We're having a educational conference for youth, and Noam Chomsky will be speaking, Barbara Ehrenreich, Francis Fox Piven, Richard Cloward, Major Owens, who is a U.S. congressman and a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, Ruth Messenger, who is a city councilwoman in New York City, will also be speaking on a panel. So it's a great lineup of speakers. It'll be a very interesting conference dealing with a whole variety of issues. Another upcoming thing that I've been working on, a lot of other DSA members have been working on, is the candidacy of Jesse Jackson, as we've been talking about. And one of the immediate tasks is not only beginning to do work in our own states, but also to go up to New Hampshire and help out with that effort. New Hampshire will have the first primary on February 16th, and as we know, it's always a sign to the nation of what some of the direction of the election might be, and there have been a lot of surprises coming out of New Hampshire in the past. So we're hoping that Jackson can provide a few surprises, do better than expected, and effectively win in New Hampshire by showing that he is viable and a candidate who could win this election. So a lot of people are going up to New Hampshire to contribute to that effort by canvassing, going door to door, talking to people about Jackson's candidacy, and then going up the 15th and 16th of February to get out the vote. But there are buses going up from New York City on the 30th and 31st of January to help canvass New Hampshire and talk to folks about Jackson's candidacy. And you can call the Jackson for President office in New York, which is at local 1199. I'm not sure what the phone number there is, but a lot of folks will be going up on that weekend and then again on February 15th and 16th.
Why don't you give your phone number one more time?
It's 212-962-0390.
Okay. Thank you very much, Elisa McBride and Bill Spencer, both of the Democratic Socialists of America, for coming by tonight. And hopefully,
yeah, thanks for having us.
No problem. Hopefully we'll hear a lot more from other groups besides the Democrats and the Republicans, because, well, I for one sure am getting sick of just a two-party system in this country, because it's just a whole lot more interesting when you have more than one, more than two points of view represented.
And we know that media is getting bored when they look for the sort of scandals that they turned up in 87, 88.
Yeah, ain't it the truth. Okay, well, thanks very much for coming by, and thanks to our listeners for calling in and for listening and becoming a part of this entire political scene and non-political scene alike. We'll be back again next week with Joe Evangelista. We'll be stepping in on the program. So tune in then. Stay tuned for The Brothers coming up at midnight with 2.5 hours of lobotomy following brain damage here on 90.1 FM WUSB. Good night.
I'm you see, all that you taste, and all you feel, and all that you love, and all that you hate, and all you distrust, and all you say, and all that you feel, and all that you see, and all that you buy.
Hi, this is Arnie with the WUSB Concert Billboard for Sunday, January 17th. Appearing this evening, McCoy Tyner at Sweet Basil, the Ramsey Lewis Trio at the Village Gate, Soulja and Aja as part of the Martin Luther King Jr. Birthday Benefit Reggae Concert to help New York's homeless children at drums. Sylvain Sylvain will be at the Limelight. The International Art of Jazz presents Vince Giordano's Nighthawks at the Ethical Humanist Society in Garden City, and Zap at SOB's, all of those shows tonight. Tomorrow night, it's Gil Evans at Sweet Basil, Kenny Dinard at the Blue Note, and the Les Paul Trio at Fat Tuesdays tomorrow evening. Tuesday, January 19th, Bad Finger at the Lone Star, Daniel Ponce at SOB's, Kevin Eubanks at Fat Tuesdays, and Ron Carter at Sweet Basil. That's Tuesday, January 19th. Wednesday, January 20th, the Ben Vaughn Combo at Siberia. Handsome Dick Manitoba's Wild Kingdom at the Cat Club. Kevin Eubanks will be at Fat Tuesdays, Pops the Rocka at Sundance in Bayshore, and Ron Carter at Sweet Basil on Wednesday, January 20th. For Thursday, January 21st, it's Billy Preston and Hiram Bullock at the Bottom Line. Eddie Palmieri at SOB's. The Fleshtones will be at Drums. Kenny Rankin at Fat Tuesdays and Ron Carter at Sweet Basil Thursday, January 21st. Friday, January 22nd, it's Dr. John at the Lone Star. Exodus, M.O.D., Leeway, and Rest in Pieces at the Ritz in Manhattan. Kenny Rankin will be at Fat Tuesdays, Marshall Crenshaw and Cindy Lee Berryhill at the Bottom Line. Pieces of a Dream at the Village Gate, Pine Top Perkins and Hubert Sumlin at Tramps, Ron Carter at Sweet Basil, Warlock and Lois Lane will be at Sundance, and Whitesnake and Great White at the Nassau Coliseum Friday, January 22nd. For Saturday, January 23rd, it's Dr. John at the Lone Star. Kenny Rankin will be at Fat Tuesdays. Marshall Crenshaw and Chris Stamey at the Bottom Line. Martha and the Vandellas, the Drifters and the Coasters at the Ritz. Pieces of a Dream at the Village Gate, Pine Top Perkins and Hubert Sumlin at Tramps. Ron Carter will be at Sweet Basil. Taj Mahal will be at the Intermedia Art Center. 9 p.m. show is sold out. Tickets still available for the 11 p.m. show. Zebra and Burning Star at Sundance. All of those shows happening Saturday, January 23rd. Other shows in January. Joe Satriani on the 26th at the Bottom Line. Paquito de Rivera and Hilton Ruiz as part of the Latin Jazz Festival, January 26th. Through February 4th at the Blue Note. Roy Ayers on the 26th will be at SOB's. Ika Mouse and Shinehead on the 27th at SOB's. Doc Watson on the 28th at the Bottom Line. Gene Loves Jezebel and Flesh for Lulu, January 28th at the Beacon Theater. Sakara Dogs and Bird Songs of the Mesozoic, January 28th at Drums. Avatar on the 29th at Showcase. The Chambers Brothers and the Spencer Davis Group on the 29th at The Saint. Dr. Hook on the 29th at The Lone Star. Joe Ely and Will Sexton on the 29th will be at The Ritz. Kiss and Ted Nugent on the 29th at the Nassau Coliseum. And Kix on the 29th at Showcase. This has been the Concert Billboard on WUSB Stony Brook for Sunday, January 17th. If you missed anything, give us a ring at 632-6901. You can catch the Concert Billboard on the weekends at noon and midnight.
And you're listening to WUSB 90.1 Stony Brook, Long Island's first station of the 90s.
This one goes out to the one I love. I've been waiting now 24 hours on the key.